Well, that was wonderful. That was tailor-made for our hearing. We appreciate special music from the three of them, from Trevor and Kathleen and Nicole. And thank you for coming, because we're always trying to find ways to test out our spiffy new sound system. And you did it, because did you notice the guitar was plugged into the system and it worked beautifully? And for Trevor and Kathleen, it's very important to have two mics. If we gave them one microphone, you know, where would you put it? So we appreciate the Robinsons testing out our system, and it sounded wonderful. Thank you very much. Nothing like good old spirited, spiffy, special music to get you dancing and singing and thinking about God's kingdom, and then we have a sermon. Hello. Back in 1995, I read a book that changed the way I read almost every book since then. It was by a man named Gregory Maguire, and the book was called Wicked. Now, I can't, of course, recommend the book to church people with a title like that. You know, yes, you must read the book Wicked. But the reason I found it fascinating was I thought I was just getting into some lighthearted reading. It was a riff on the Wizard of Oz story. And I know you all know the Wizard of Oz story. While Mr. Thomas was playing with grenades, I was watching the Wizard of Oz on TV every year and getting scared by the flying monkeys and things like that. The story is only a little more than 100 years old, and it's a very American story. And it's something that has entered the common mind of the world, and many variations of the story have been told. But I found this book, Wicked, to be fascinating, because what it was the same story, but told from the point of view of the Wicked Witch of the West. And it made the Wicked Witch of the West, you know, I say those words, and because we all know Wizard of Oz, you think, boom, villain, mean, melting, you know. Terrible person, surrender Dorothy, things like that. She's a villain, she's bad. But this made her into the good person of the novel. And Dorothy was the annoying thing from Kansas that kept getting in the way. And it turned out that this person, her name was Elphaba in the story, turned out to be an intelligent, educated, compassionate person with a lot of heart. She was best friends with her college roommate, Glinda. And when they got together, they pretended like they were fighting with each other, but really they had quite a good friendship. And the point is, you know, I can't really recommend the book. It turned into a major musical on Broadway that we've seen, and it's very well done just from a production point of view. But I realized at that point that you could read a story and that you could find things in it that totally weren't there, that if with some understanding of the person, that you had to be careful, and the details that came out could give you compassion for a person whom you would think you would have no compassion or sympathy for. And by the end of the story, you're not only rooting for the Wicked Witch of the West, but you just want Dorothy to go back to Kansas. She's kind of ruining everything. And so many things that I've read since then, I've read differently. I look at the story and I read the facts and I think, is that how they really add up? And sometimes it is how they add up, and sometimes you have to be careful. And what I want to talk about today is a story that I think is along those lines. I want to talk about one of the most interesting men in the Bible, at least to me. I would say to me, he's the second most interesting character in the entire Bible. We can talk over refreshments about who the first might be. That's not the same as saying my favorite character or the best character. There's lots of detailed information about this person, most of which is found in one book of the Bible, which is the book we call 1 Samuel. We have more details about this person than we do about most other people in the Bible. We hear his name and we lump him in with the villains immediately, and rightly so, he was a villain. But it wasn't always so, and there is much more to the story. His name is Saul. More importantly, in my mind, he falls into a special group of people, and there's a reason for our lives today to take careful consideration of his life story, which I will explain later. Let's jump in. Let's turn to 1 Samuel. It's a story. I mean, you know, the Bible has all kinds of literature in it, but this is actually the story part. And 1 Samuel is one of the more exciting parts of the Bible. There's actually all kinds of action going on and intrigue and soap opera. There's all kinds of things. When we come to 1 Samuel 7, Samuel is already established as the judge, the last judge of Israel. And the ark has returned to Israel, and all kinds of things are going on. And we're going to have to gloss over a lot of the story. I know that most of you have read this. If you haven't, I highly recommend that you read the story of this man and the people whose lives he affected, because number one, it reads very easily and beautifully, and it holds your interest. But also, at least in the first part, it reads like a very beautiful fairy tale. I mean, it is so good that you can't believe it. In 1 Samuel 7 and in verse 3, Samuel is telling the Israelites that the ark has come back, and he's saying, now turn your hearts back and return to the Lord your God. And they gather at a place called Mizpah. And when the Philistines heard that they had gathered there — the Philistines were really the bad guys here. I mean, they wanted to kill all the Israelites, which makes them bad guys in this book. And so you read that the Philistines gathered, the people were afraid, and God delivers them. It's hard to believe how he does it, but as Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near and God threw them into confusion, because God led in those days through his judges at that point. Israel had a king at one point, the son of Gideon named Abimelech, but that didn't last very long, and we don't even count him in the lineup of kings. But what happened at this point was that the Israelites were very aware that one day could change their entire existence. They could be wiped out or enslaved, taken away by the Philistines, and they realized how much danger they were in at this point. And Samuel had them trusting him, and they had him trusting God, and God did deliver them. They didn't have to fight this war. They were delivered from the Philistines. There were other things going on, and that's one of the things you find out about this story, is that all the facts aren't delivered in linear order. You learn some things later that had to do a lot with earlier things in the story. And a couple of things that were going on at this point was that the Israelites did not have steel or iron. The Philistines had iron, and their weapons were made out of iron, and they took great pains to make sure that the Israelites didn't have iron, and so that they could dominate them militarily at all times. It doesn't mention that till a much later chapter. There was also a man named Nachash, and he was active at this point. And his story is, yes, it is in the scriptures later on, but it isn't in all the translations of the Bible. If you're reading from the New King James or the New International Version or the King James Version, which most of you are, then this story is probably told in a short form in 1 Samuel 11. So I don't even have to have you turn to this scripture. It happens to be in the translation that I'm using. It's backed up by Josephus, and it is backed up in Hebrew manuscripts. It's just not in the Masoretic text, but it's something that historically did happen. And it is mentioned again. It just might not be in your Bible. In case you want to turn to where I'm reading, I'm at the end of 1 Samuel chapter 10, but your Bible probably doesn't have these verses. Your Bible probably ends with a sentence, but Saul held his peace, or Saul stayed quiet, or something like that. But there was a king of a people named the Ammonites, part of the Canaanites. This king was named Nahash, and I'll just read what the manuscript says. Now Nahash, king of the Ammonites, had been grievously oppressing the Gadites and the Reubenites. He would gouge out the right eye of each of them and would not grant Israel a deliverer. No one was left of the Israelites across the Jordan whose right eye Nahash, king of the Ammonites, had not gouged out. But there were 7,000 men who had escaped from the Ammonites and had entered Jabesh Gilead. And this was going on at the time that we read about in 1 Samuel 7, when the Israelites were gathered together. So what was on their mind was that they wanted a king. And it was not an unreasonable thing to talk about. Samuel did try to talk them out of it. Samuel was personally offended. He had his own money in the game, so to speak. And he tried very hard to be fair and unbiased about the whole thing, but you can see that his emotions do enter into it too. So let's read the story in 1 Samuel 8. And this is, of course, before we ever meet the main character that we're going to talk about today. In 1 Samuel 8, when Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. Now think about Samuel. He was raised by an old man with two horrible sons. His mother and father gave him up at a very small age. And so he basically grew up in the equivalent of a temple. His mother would visit him, but he had a very strange upbringing. So it's not a surprise that we read in chapter 2, about verse 2, about his own sons. The name of his firstborn son was Joel, and the name of his second, Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. This whole story, by the way, takes place in a very small geographic area. It talks about all different cities, but really, they were all within long walking distance of each other. Yet his sons, Samuel's sons, did not follow in his ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. And Ramah was Samuel's home. That's where he actually lived. He had a circuit where he went to different cities, but he would come home to Ramah. And said to him, and you know this part of the story, you are old, your sons do not follow in your ways, appoint for us then a king to govern us like other nations. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to govern us. And so Samuel took this to the Lord. Now Samuel not only talked to the Lord, but the Lord talked to Samuel in ways that Samuel could understand. It was different than with us. I mean, we can see how God talks to us, but sometimes we have to really have our eyes open. Whereas Samuel apparently either heard words or somehow received direct thoughts as a response to things. And the other judges were the same. So it was a different way that God dealt with people. And in verse 7, the Lord said to Samuel, listen to the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them, just as they have done to me. In other words, God's saying, it's really me that they're rejecting. You know, God had just delivered people from the Philistines through a judge. It could be done. But these people were very afraid, and they wanted a king. So Samuel not only tells these people what God had said, he said in verse 9, God said, now then, listen to their voice only. You shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them. So Samuel said, this is what's going to happen. In verse 11, he said, these will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots. He will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties. He will appoint some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest, to make his implements of war, the equipment of chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his courtiers. He will take one-tenth of your grain and of your vineyards and give it to his officers and his courtiers. Samuel's laying it on thick. He will take your male and female slaves and the best of your cattle and donkeys and put them to work. He will take a tenth of your flocks and you shall be his slaves. In that day you will cry out because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. I believe Samuel made himself clear. There was no doubting. He was saying, it's not a good thing. But the people refused to listen. And they said, no, we are determined to have a king over us so that we may be like other nations. And remember, they were in danger every day of their lives at this point. So it may not have been right, but it was understandable. Verse 22, the Lord said to Samuel, listen to their voice and set a king over them. Samuel then said to the people of Israel, each of you return home. Then in chapter 9, the story starts. The story about Saul. And as I said, it reads like a fairy tale, a good fairy tale, but it's true. There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, a man of wealth. He had a son whose name was Saul, a handsome young man. There was not a man among the people of Israel more handsome than he. He stood head and shoulders above everyone else. Now the donkeys of Kish, Saul's father, had strayed. So Kish said to his son Saul, take one of the boys with you, go and look for the donkeys. And they passed through the hill country of Ephraim and passed through the land of Shalisha, but they did not find them. So they're on a quest. They're looking for donkeys at this point. Verse 5, when they came to the land of Zuph, which was an ancestral home for Saul's family. Saul said to the boy who was with him, "Let us turn back, or my father will stop worrying about the donkeys and worry about us." But as in all good tales, there was a twist here. And the servant said, "There is a man of God in this town, and he's a man who's held in honor. Whatever he said always comes true." So the idea was to go find this man of God and ask him where the donkeys were, because that's what men of God do. They tell you where your missing animals are, and they have nothing better to do at that point. Saul says to the boy, "But what can we bring him?" Because he couldn't imagine going to anybody empty-handed and getting an answer. He knew, he felt that he had to pay him. He said, "The bread in our sacks is gone, and there is no present to bring the man of God. What do we have?" Verse 8, the boy answered Saul again, "Well, I have with me a quarter shekel of silver. I'll give it to the man of God to tell us our way." Formerly in Israel, anyone who went to inquire of God would say, "Come, let us go to the seer." For the one who is now called a prophet was formerly called a seer. So they went to the town where the man of God was. And as they came near, the handsome man met some girls who were coming out to draw water. And he said, "Is the seer here?" They answered, "Yes, he is just ahead of you. Hurry, he has come to town because the people have a sacrifice today at the shrine." This uses the term shrine. The word is actually high place. And we come to associate high places with wickedness in Israel, but the things that went on at this high place were totally approved of God. So it wasn't the places themselves. And it literally means an elevated place. It was what was done in them. They answered, "Yes, he's just ahead of you. Hurry, he has just come to town because the people have a sacrifice today. And as soon as you enter the town, you will find him because people can't start till he comes." They entered the town and they saw Samuel. In verse 15, we find out, as in all good tales, that there is a backstory to this, that the day before the handsome man showed up, the Lord had revealed to Samuel, "Tomorrow about this time, I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him to be ruler over my people Israel. He shall save my people from the hand of the Philistines, for I have seen the suffering of my people because their outcry has come to me." So God acknowledged it was a real thing. When Samuel saw Saul, the Lord told him, "Here is the man of whom I spoke to you. He it is who shall rule over my people." Well, Saul shows up. He's a humble man. He's tall and he's handsome. He's also not the brightest tack in the box, as the story will show us as we go on. He's not stupid by any means. He's just a fairly normal person. He's young. He doesn't really know the ways of the world. He doesn't know what to do. He's a little bit on the shy side. He doesn't know his own abilities. And he says in verse 10, "Tell me, please, where is the house of the seer?" Samuel said, "I am the seer. Go up before me, and today you're going to eat with me. And in the morning, I will let you go, and I'll tell you what's on your mind. And don't worry about the donkeys," he said. "They were found 3 days ago." And Saul's going, "Oh, something's going on here." And Samuel sits him down. Samuel says, "And on whom is all Israel's desire fixed, if not on you and on all your ancestral house?" Well, Saul is thinking, "I'm out looking for donkeys. What on earth? What is this bit about Israel being focused on me? What's going on here?" Saul says, and this is indicative of what a nice young man he was at this time, "I am only a Benjaminite. He was raised well from the least of the tribes of Israel. And my family is the humblest of all the families of the tribes of Benjamin. Why are you talking to me this way?" Well, then Samuel took Saul and his servant boy and brought them into the hall and gave them a place at the head table at this banquet that had been set up. And there were about 30 people there. And Samuel called out the chef. And he says, "Chef, bring the portion that I gave you, the one I asked you to put aside." So the chef comes out and says, "Mr. Saul, we have a special tonight, and we have saved you the very best meat and the fixings that go with it." And he set them before Saul. Well, Saul and his servant, I'm sure, are hungry. And being the tallest, he was probably also one of the hungriest people in Israel too. Samuel said, "See what is kept for you. I did this ahead of time. Eat, for it is set before you at the appointed time so that you might eat with the guests." So Samuel did the right thing and he ate. Saul ate with Samuel that day. When they came from the shrine into the town, Samuel had prepared a bed on his roof, which was the place where people slept, where it would be nice and cool and he could sleep. he and his servant. And at the break of dawn, Samuel called Saul upon the roof and said, get up so that I may send you on your way. Saul got up, and both he and Samuel, and it doesn't mention, and the servant went out into the street. As they were going down to the outskirts of the town, Samuel said to Saul, tell the boy to go on before us. And when he had passed on, when he has passed on, stop here for a while, because I have to talk to you. I have to make known to you what God wants to do. Well, Samuel can't believe, or Saul can't believe what's going on at this point. And Samuel, I mean, picture yourself in this situation. You're looking for donkeys. You've had a nice meal. You want to get home. Your father's going to be worried about you. And this old man who is a seer takes you aside. And Samuel was a Nazirite. He probably had long hair. He was unusual looking. Samuel took a vial of oil and poured it on his head, because that's how people make you comfortable. They dump oil on your head, and kissed him. And that's also how people make you feel really comfortable. And he said, the Lord has anointed you ruler over his people, Israel. You shall reign over the people of the Lord, and you will save them from the hand of their enemies all around. And he talks about various signs. He said, when you depart from me today, you will meet two men by Rachel's tomb. That was local in the territory of Benjamin. They will say to you, the donkeys are found. Now your father has stopped worrying about them and is worrying about you, which is what Saul had basically said. Then you'll go further and you'll come to the Oak of Tabor. And Tabor seems to be related to the name Deborah. When you think about it, it's the same consonants. And it's thought that this was an oak where she might have sat. Three men going up to God at Bethel, where there was an altar, will meet you there, one carrying three kids, goats, another carrying three loaves of bread, and another carrying a skin of wine. I guess the details were just so that Saul would be impressed, because all they were going to offer Saul was two loaves of bread, but Saul would be hungry, and he said, you will accept this from them. After that, you will go to Gibeath Elohim, which is Gibeath of God, at the place where the Philistine garrison is. There, as you come to town, you will meet a band of prophets coming down from the shrine with harp, tambourine, flute, and lyre playing in front of them. And then these next words, we really don't know what they mean, but we get a general idea. In this translation, it says they will be in a prophetic frenzy. In other words, they'll be making music. They will be dancing. They will have the rhythm going, and it'll overtake them. They'll be in really good spirits, and they're better able to worship God when they do this. And then verse 6, key verse to this whole story. Then the Spirit of God will possess you, and you will be in a prophetic frenzy along with them and be turned into a different person. You will receive a spirit, and you will be turned into a different person. The person he is right now is not kingly, but God is going to change that. God's going to rewire him. It's a little different from the way God works with other people. Now, when these signs meet you, do whatever you see fit to do, for God is with you. And then the next verse, verse 8, is a very confusing verse. Sometimes I feel that this verse should be lifted and put into a different chapter where it would make more sense. But it says, and you shall go down to Gilgal, which isn't far away, but Gilgal is a town, a place that plays a big role in the story of Saul and Samuel. Then I will come down to you to present burnt offerings and offer sacrifices of well-being. 7 days you shall wait till I come to you and show you what to do. This doesn't happen. And it makes me wonder sometimes if it isn't part of a story that comes later. But maybe what it shows us is that Saul is capable of ignoring instructions. And bear in mind, he hasn't had his spirit changed at that point. Because Saul doesn't do this. He doesn't wait 7 days for Samuel, and Samuel doesn't seem to show up in 7 days. So as I said, it seems to be a different story. And we don't know if this is a first sign of trouble in Saul's head. He seems to be either disobeying or forgetting it. But we also have to bear in mind that he's very reluctant, that he is overcome at this point. He doesn't know what to do, and he doesn't want to take part, as we'll see. Verse 9, as he turned away to leave Samuel, God gave him another heart. He wasn't kingly. God made him kingly. When they were going from there to Gibeah, a band of prophets met him, and the Spirit of God possessed him, and he fell into a prophetic frenzy along with them. So he started singing along with them. And this was very out of character for him. And when all who knew him before saw how he prophesied with the prophets, the people said to one another, what this means is people knew who this man was. His father may be worried that he's out looking at donkeys, but these people knew who they were dealing with, and they knew he was right there. So news probably got back to his father. We know it got back to his uncle. And they said, what has come over the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets? And that's a very important phrase. A man of the place answered, and who is their father? Therefore, it became a proverb, is Saul also among the prophets? And that haunted him the rest of his life. And then when his prophetic frenzy had ended, he went home. Doesn't mention about waiting 7 days. Now, there is some joke here with a punchline. I don't get it. One of the things I'm going to ask in the world tomorrow is, would you explain this one to me? Because people are having a good time. They're making fun of Saul. They're laughing. And apparently what the man says, and who is their father, apparently that was very clever. And I've tried to approach this story from all sides, and I can't make it funny. But I think it is. I think it's supposed to be. And it's a story that followed Saul all the way along. In this case, it's a happy thing, because he's just changed and changed for the better. Later on, it gets a little more poignant and a lot more sad. Saul's uncle said to him and to the boy, where did you go? And he replied, to seek the donkeys. When we saw they were not to be found, we went to Samuel. Saul's uncle said, tell me what Samuel told you. And Saul said, he told us that the donkeys had been found. Now that's casual. He didn't tell him anything about the rest of the story, even though his heart had already been changed. So Saul was still processing at this point. He wasn't convinced. So this is kind of the first coronation of Saul, but I don't know if you noticed, no one ever used the word king. Samuel never used the word king. Saul never used the word king. He was a leader, maybe a prince, but this was the private Samuel telling Saul that he was going to be king, but the people didn't know anything about this. So what happens next in verse 17, Samuel summons the people to Mizpah again, where they were when the Philistines had been defeated. And he said to them, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I'm going to give you a king, basically, to make it short. And they start using the Urim and the Thummim to draw lots. Samuel, in verse 20, brought all the tribes of Israel near, and the tribe of Benjamin was taken by lot. So God is backing this up. Then he brought the tribe of Benjamin near and its families, and the family of Matrites was taken by lot, and that was Saul's family. Finally, he brought the family of Matrites near, man by man, and Saul, the son of Kish, was taken by lot. But there's only one problem. He's not there. I don't know how they took his name by lot when they didn't bring him there, but he couldn't be found. And this, the great king of Israel, the man who's taller and handsomer and tougher than anybody else in town, is hiding in the luggage. He's hiding in the bags. He's hoping that they won't find him and that this is all a bad dream. And he can just go back to his dad and his donkeys and just live life the way he had planned to. You know, he was going to grow up and be a baker in town or something like that. Who knows what his plans were. He was going to get married and raise 5 children and who knows what would go on. But instead, verse 24, they drag him out. He's tall. Yes, he's tall. I think you know my son is tall. He's 6'9". He has a shirt that just says, yes, I know. Because everyone comes up to him and says, you're tall. And they say, do you play basketball? And so the shirt just says, yes, I know. Well, that's what Saul needed at this point. Samuel says, do you see the one whom the Lord has chosen? There was no one like him among all the people. And all the people shouted, long live the king. Samuel tells them the rights of a king. And notice that in verse 27, Saul went home, and with him went some warriors whom God had inspired at that point. They were on his side, but not everybody felt that way. In verse 27, some worthless fellows said, how can this man save us? They despised him and brought him no present for his coronation, but he held his peace. He was quiet. He didn't want to he thought it would be the wrong time. So this is wisdom on his part, and he's showing the effects of God's spirit. This was the second coronation, but there is another. Now, then our friend Nahash, the eye putter outer, shows up again. And in verse 11, it actually talks about him in your Bible. You will see in those first verses that he's mentioned, but without the same explanation that I gave you from Josephus before. And so they set it up that Nahash is going to put out everybody's eyes the next morning. He's happy. He's ready. And they said, just give us a day and we'll come out tomorrow. So all is well. Well, Saul, in verse 5, was coming from the field behind the oxen. So he'd gone back to his dad, and he was plowing at this point because he didn't have it in his mind to be a king. Saul said, what is the matter with the people that they are weeping? And they told him about the message from the inhabitants of Jabesh, that this king was going to come, capture them all, and put their eyes out and demand tribute. The Spirit of God came upon Saul in power. And notice it doesn't mince words. This is the Spirit of God. When he heard these words, and his anger was greatly kindled. So it seems like the Spirit was something that came in waves to Saul. It wasn't always there. Sometimes he plowed. Sometimes he reacted like this. He took a yoke of oxen, cut them in pieces, and sent them throughout all the territory of Israel by messengers and said, if you don't want this to happen to your oxen, you come out and fight with me. Then the dread of the Lord fell upon the people, and they came as one. When he mustered them at Bezek, those from Israel were 300,000, those from Judah, 70,000. And to make a long story short, they won. Saul actually had a strategy, which you can read about. And then in verse 12, people's hearts have changed. The people said to Samuel, this was a big victory. Nahash is no longer a problem. They cut down the Ammonites. No two of them were left together. The people said, who is it that said, shall Saul reign over us? Give them to us so that we may put them to death. Let's get rid of those people who weren't gung-ho for Saul. But Saul said, no one shall be put to death this day, for today the Lord has brought deliverance to Israel. Samuel said to the people, come, let us go to Gilgal. This is the equivalent, by the way, of Ding Dong the Witch is Dead, to go back to a further analogy. I mean, this is happiness. The bad is gone, the good is there, and no one is going to be put to death today. So Saul is using God's Spirit, and he's acting like a king. And so they do renew the kingship, and all is well. Well, we have to zip through a lot of this, but that was the third coronation. We know that Saul had had a change of heart and that God had changed Saul's heart. But then things start to happen. We know about this, and we know that Saul at one point is supposed to wait for Samuel to make sacrifices, and he does not. And so it seems like he's doing the right thing. And I want to read those verses to you. Oh, by the way, though, let's look at 1 Samuel 13 and verse 1. And my Bible says, Saul was blank years old when he began to reign, and he reigned blank 2 years over Israel. Well, we know that can't be true. He grew up, he had children. It turns out that there are actually words missing here, that we don't have the right text. And so it's been added in some translations that Saul was 30 years old, and that seems about right. And we learned from Paul in Acts 13 that Saul reigned about 40 years over Israel. So maybe it was 42 years. As God had intended him to do, he vanquished the Philistines. That was his job, and that was what he did. But Samuel was supposed to come and give a sacrifice before they actually went out to battle. And Saul did not wait the complete 7 days. He waited like 6 days and 23 hours or something like that. And Samuel didn't show up. And so Saul started making the sacrifices, which was not what he was supposed to do. And it was very serious. And so Samuel announces something in chapter 13 and verse 13. Saul has just explained, I forced myself and I offered the burnt offering. I didn't want to do it, but I didn't have a choice. You didn't give me a choice, so I did it. And in some ways, his decision seems sane and sound and like the good thing. But Samuel says, you have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. The Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever, but now your kingdom will not continue, for the Lord has sought out a man after his own heart. And the Lord has appointed him to be a ruler over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. But then he goes on his way, and the Philistines are beaten, and it seems like God ignores the whole thing. I want to read this passage from a different translation, The Message, which some of you know. And I hope my phone is working so I can do this. But I want to read what Samuel said from The Message. And this is scripturally accurate. It's just a different take on it. It's not sure that God had actually found a person at that point, but that he was looking for a replacement. Samuel said, that was a fool thing to do. If you had kept the appointment that your God commanded, by now God would have set a firm and lasting foundation under your kingly rule over Israel. As it is, your kingly rule is already falling to pieces, and it's Saul's fault. God is out looking for your replacement right now, and that was what was going on. This time he'll do the choosing, and when he finds him, he'll appoint him leader of his people, all because you didn't keep your appointment with God. But at this point, God lets it go, and Saul is still king. So we read about the exploits of Saul and Jonathan in here before we ever encounter David. And there is an interesting series of verses in the middle of all this. There's all kinds of drama going on. But in chapter 14 and verse 31, up until this point, one of the things that makes Saul unusual and different from David later on is that he doesn't seem to actually have his own relationship with God. He seems to have it through Samuel. You know, and God said he was looking for a man of his own heart. So Samuel may have been reprogrammed to be kingly. It wasn't his nature and it wasn't his idea. But there's very little indication that he had his own respect and interest in God. Although he would do things like make sacrifices, he had the right impulses because he knew what he was supposed to do as a leader. The only time that's in doubt is here in 1 Samuel 14 and starting in verse 31. It talks about the troops were very faint in verse 32, Samuel 14 and verse 32. So the troops flew upon the spoil and took sheep and oxen and calves and slaughtered them on the ground, and the troops ate them with the blood. They were so hungry they just ripped animals up and started eating them. Then it was reported to Saul, look, the troops are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood. And he said, Saul said, you have dealt treacherously. Roll a large stone before me here. Samuel's nowhere around. Saul said, disperse yourselves among the troops and say to them, let them all bring their oxen or their sheep and slaughter them here and eat, and do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood. So all the troops brought their oxen with them that night and slaughtered them there. And Saul built an altar to the Lord, and it was the first altar that he built to the Lord. And this is the only indication we get that Saul really pursued the Lord himself. Well, trouble has begun. What's interesting up to this point is that Saul has been a pretty good king. All the warnings that Samuel made about taking your money, taking your children, most of them didn't come true. Saul did take people to be soldiers, and he did take some money, and of course his court had to be paid for, but he didn't build a huge bureaucracy like later kings did, and he didn't particularly go for riches. Interestingly enough, his capital at Gibeah has been excavated, and it's pretty much thought to be Saul's capital. He had no large palace. He didn't have a harem. His capital is a simple rustic fortress. And when all these things take place in Saul's palace, it's really a simple rustic fortress. When we get to chapter 15, we get to the point of no return, where Saul gets rejected by God and he can't go on again. And you know this story. Saul was supposed to wipe out the Amalekites. I'm going to count on you knowing this story. Saul was supposed to wipe out the Amalekites and kill the king, and instead he kept the animals for the Israelites, and he didn't kill the king. And Samuel showed up and said, what am I hearing? Moo, ba, what am I hearing? And Saul said, animals. And he said, weren't you supposed to kill these? And Saul said, well, he's thinking fast. He said, I kept them for sacrifices. That's right, they're going to be sacrifices, and that's why we kept them. And in verse 17 of chapter 15, Samuel says, though you are little in your own eyes, are you not still head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel. The Lord sent you on a mission and said, go utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them. Why did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil and do what is evil in the sight of the Lord? Saul said to Samuel, I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. I have gone on a mission with the Lord sent me, and I have brought Agag, the king of Amalek, and I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But that wasn't what he was supposed to do. And in verse 22, Saul says, has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices and is in obedience to the voice of the Lord? Surely to obey is better than sacrifice and to heed than the fat of rams. And we quote that today, but it has a very specific application to this story where Saul claimed he was going to make sacrifices. For rebellion is no less a sin than witchcraft, and stubbornness is like iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. Well, Saul is very sorry, and he begs Samuel and God to forgive him at this point, which Samuel said it's too late. But what he does do is in front of his men, he still upholds Samuel. You can read that story. Verse 16, chapter 16 is a happier chapter. It talks about David entering the picture. And bear in mind, when Samuel was coronated all three times, there was no David. If God was looking for a man after his own heart, it's possible there wasn't anyone to answer that call. David was born later. He was probably younger than Saul's son Jonathan, and there was no Jonathan back in the days when Saul was made king. He wasn't even married at that point. It wasn't until later that those things happened. And so many years had gone by before David is anointed. And Samuel does it secretly. He doesn't want Saul to find out because he knows Saul would be furious. In chapter 16 and verse 14, we read a poignant, sad, final verse. And by final, I mean it has finality to it. It says, now the spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord tormented him. And Saul's servants said to him, see now an evil spirit from God is tormenting him. And you know the story. They find a man who is a harpist who comes in and plays easy listening music for him. And Saul is soothed by it. Do you know any Barry Manilow, he says? Of course, Barry Manilow didn't exist, but David was known as a harper at that point. And so who enters the story at that point but David? And David actually had God's spirit, and God's spirit and David seemed to resonate with Saul. When the two of them were together, there were usually one of two results. Either Saul's evil spirit left him and the spirit in David resonated and Saul became a better person, or it infuriated Saul and Saul would do little things like throw spears at him to try to pin him against the wall. So it could go either way, but the point is that the spirit of the Lord that God had definitely given Saul was gone at this point. And you know the rest of the story at this point about the fights between David and Saul, how Saul was trying to kill David for the next matter of years, and David would escape. And it would happen time and time again. And Saul chased him through the wilderness. And David went for refuge to Samuel and for advice. And all kinds of things happen. And there's, of course, a very poignant story in chapter 19. Samuel had kind of said that he wasn't going to see Saul again, but Saul changed that. And in 1 Samuel 19, David is worn out. He has gone to Samuel in Ramah, and Saul shows up again. In chapter 19 and verse 18, David fled and escaped. He came to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. He and Samuel went and settled at Naoth. Naoth was cabins. It was like a camp. It was a refuge. Saul was told, David is at Naoth in Ramah. Saul sent messengers to take David. When they saw the company of the prophets in a frenzy, and you've heard this story before, with Samuel standing in charge of them. So Samuel was there watching. The Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul. It didn't become a part of them like it becomes a part of his children today, but it came upon them and took over, and they fell into a prophetic frenzy. When Saul was told, he sent other messengers. Same thing happened to him. And he sent messengers a third time, and the same thing happened. So he said, I'm going myself. He came to the great well that is in Sekou, and he said, where are Samuel and David? And someone said, Naoth in Ramah. He went there, and the Spirit of God came upon him as it had before. But this time, it's a sad thing. And as he was going, he fell into a prophetic frenzy until he came to Naoth at Ramah. And he stripped off his clothes, and he too fell in a frenzy before Samuel. And he lay naked all that day and all that night. And then this, although it doesn't say, is one of the saddest verses. It says, therefore, it is said, is Saul also among the prophets? Because all the people saw his degradation and his decline. And they used the same thing that was a happy thing decades before. And the story had kept going to mark how far he had fallen at that point. It was a point of no return. He was jealous of David. He was definitely a villain. There's no question about it. He was so jealous that he tried to kill him. He slaughtered 85 priests at Nob. He consulted a witch. You know the story. There's one more episode, though, that I would like to address, and that's in chapter 24. And you know this, but the words are so poignant and so beautiful. This is where Saul goes into a cave to relieve himself, and David is in the back of the cave, and David can kill him. But he chooses not to. And David calls out to him and says in chapter 8, or verse 8 of chapter 24, he says, my lord the king. And Saul looked behind him. David bowed with his face to the ground and did obeisance. David said to Saul, why do you listen to the words of those who say David seeks to do you harm? Because all that Saul is doing at this point is chasing David to kill him. This very day, your eyes have seen how the Lord gave you into my hand in the cave, and some urged me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, I will not raise my hand against the Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. See, my father, he calls him that tenderly, see the corner of your cloak in my hand, for by the fact that I cut off the corner of your cloak and didn't kill you, you may know for certain there is no wrong or reason in my hands. He goes on to say, may the Lord judge between us. Who do you pursue, a dead dog or a single flea? May the Lord therefore judge and give sentence between me and you. May he see to it and plead my cause and vindicate me against you. And then Saul spoke. And Saul was in the presence of David and God's Holy Spirit. And apparently it touched something in his heart. For he says in verse 17, you are more righteous than I, for you have repaid me good, whereas I have repaid you evil. Today you've explained how you've dealt with me and that you did not kill me when the Lord put me into your hands. And bear in mind, his armies are outside waiting to smash this young, what he thinks is a rebel, into bits. But Saul is speaking to him quietly in here. For who has ever found an enemy and sent the enemy safely away? So may the Lord reward you with good for what you have done to me this day. Now I know that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel will be established in your hand. Swear to me, therefore, by the Lord, that you will not cut off my descendants after me, and that you will not wipe out my name from my father's house. So Samuel swore this to Saul, and it affected his later decisions on things. Saul went home, David and his men went up to the stronghold, and a third thing happened that the next verse says, and Samuel died. So Saul was rudderless at this point. He no longer had Samuel to help him in any way. Even if he would be willing to help him, it wasn't going to happen anymore. And you know, he fell further and further, consulted a witch, fell on his own sword in battle, finally, and died. Even though he had spent years fighting the Philistines successfully, in the end, he was killed by them. David became king. It wasn't that simple. Saul's son first became king for 2 years, and David had his own issues before all of Judah and Israel accepted him as king, but it did happen. And this is a dot, 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 end of the story, but we have to ask ourselves, what was God up to here? Because in Genesis 14, you know, even when God made Saul king the first time, he took the tallest, handsomest man from Benjamin. And yet already in Genesis 14, Jacob, one of the patriarchs, had already relayed God's prophecies that the scepter would be in Judah and it would always be in Judah, and that the king of God's people would start out in Judah and eventually, you know, would be taken by the Messiah who would stem from the tribe of Judah. And such a thing did happen. And when those promises were made, David wasn't even born. You know, sometimes I think we think, well, the world is full of people that God could use, but I'm not sure that that's true. And one of the reasons God ends up using flawed people is he has to work with the inventory on the shelves. And that puts quite a burden on us because we have to be ready for God to use us. And maybe the reason, if we feel God is not quite living up to our expectations of how God should be, is because we aren't living up to God's expectations of us. And you have to wonder about that. So David didn't exist when God made those promises. David didn't exist when God installed Saul as a king. And what God was looking for at that point was someone to answer the people's pleas, someone in a way to teach them a lesson, but someone who could literally rout the Philistines at that point. And Saul did. And in some ways, he was a good king, as I have pointed out before. David's line, he became the king, and God made a promise to him that his line would continue through the Messiah, and it did. And it does to this day. You know, our king will come back, and he will be from the tribe of Judah. So that's already been fulfilled, and nothing can interfere with it at this point. That's already history. In my mind, Saul belongs to a select group of people, a rare group of humans, whom God used and with whom God worked in unique ways, ways that not a single other human was worked with. And it changed humanity and it changed God. Now you can say, well, God doesn't change, but God does grow. And when working with these people, he makes decisions and he says things like, never again am I going to do this. I apologize, by the way, for going over, but I'm not stopping. One of these people was Enoch. God was special friends with a man named Enoch. He translated him in some ways. We have our elaborate ideas of what that means, but we don't know what it means. We know that God treated him a certain way and never treated another human being exactly that way again. God moved on. There was a man named Noah. God used Noah and his family. Noah, you know, talk about the inventory on the shelves. Noah was what was available at that time. He wasn't perfect, but God used him to continue humankind. We all owe a huge debt, like every breath we take, to the fact that Noah was a righteous man and brought humanity through at that point. And then God said, never again. I'm not doing that again. I've learned from this. And because Noah has gone through it and I've wiped out people, other people won't have to go through this. There was a man by the name of Job. That's how the book starts. And I thank God often that Job existed, because God worked with Job in a certain way, and we have Job's example in front of us, and we don't have to go through the terrible things that Job went through. I can't imagine losing all your children, everything you own, everything except a wife who is going to complain to you every minute, it seems like. And yet, because Job went through that, and he was a man of God, I mean, the book is clear. And at the beginning, he was a man of God, and at the end, he was a man of God. And we'll stand with and learn from Job in the world tomorrow. But because God worked with Job in that way, other human beings don't have to go through that. We can learn from Job's example, and we do. There was a man named Elijah, a very powerful prophet who did incredible things. But at the end of his life, Elijah was very depressed. And he said to God, I can't do this anymore. And God was kind to Elijah. And God took him away at that point. He didn't kill him. He just moved him to a different place and gave his job to someone else. But I always think of Elijah when I'm depressed. And when things are getting me down, I think God will be kind to me, but I still have to do this job. Because one of the things that God said to Elijah was, you know, I've got thousands of people out there. You think you're alone. But God was kind to him. And he hasn't treated anybody else quite the way he treated Elijah. And he's moved on. Well, God used Saul to answer a specific need in people's history. And the difference was that there's no indication that Saul was ever what we would call converted. And we know the ramifications of that word. We don't have to explain it. Saul answered that need. No indication that Saul ever sought out God for his own relationship. He was never a man of faith, but he was a man of duty. God changed him, technically against his will, God changed him. Saul didn't have the personal integrity or character to live up to everything, although he did rise to the occasion in many ways, in admirable ways. But by the end, it cost him his mind, the conflict between the Spirit of God and the evil things that he did. Cost him his mind. God supported him as king, but when Saul's action made it clear that he had rejected God, then God moved on. And God didn't do that again. God gave Saul his spirit. God gave Saul his spirit, and it sounds like it was his Holy Spirit, but Saul never sought God out. He never turned to God. In Hebrews 11:6, the one verse that doesn't have the word Samuel in the title, Hebrews 11:6, you know that in the faith chapter, the writer, he's actually talking about Enoch here, but in Hebrews 11, verse 6, he says, and without faith, it is impossible to please God, for whoever would approach him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. And Saul was not a proven man of faith. Saul was a physical Israelite who did a job that he was called to do. God rewired him, not in ways that Saul chose to do, but God changed him into a different person. And there's no indication that God would ever do that again. And the important thing for our lives is that's not the way God works. One of the things in history is that God has to be able to say, I gave you every chance. And he showed that working with a person and giving them their Holy Spirit does not guarantee a single thing. And actually, it's not indicated that he condemned Saul. He turned away from Saul and he left Saul to his own devices and he met an undignified end. David certainly didn't turn away from Saul. David refused to kill God's anointed, but I think there's more to it than we understand, because David was a person after after God's own heart. And when he was talking to Saul, I can't help but feeling that that resonated with him, and that he knew that he was dealing with a fragile person here, and all this person may be strong with armies and trying to kill him, that this was a person God had worked in with a very special way, and David had no business interfering into it. It wasn't so much that Saul chose to disobey, although he did choose to disobey. I want to make that clear. He was a villain, as that it was impossible for him to live up to everything that was needed from him without being a child of God. He was never going to be the man after God's own heart, and God didn't call him to be that person. We never hear of God rewiring someone again without them asking to. That's maybe the most important part of the story, is that God cannot have children unless they turn to him and seek him, although no one can ever say he didn't try. And that has a lot to do with us, and it should be a great inspiration to you, because every one of you is one of those people who has turned to God at that point. It also tells us how exceptional David was and how exceptional God's children are today. Well, I'm not telling this story in its fullness. I've glossed over so much of it. I just wanted you to see a different side of Saul, like Gregory Maguire taught me to see a different side of the Wicked Witch of the West. But Saul was real. And sometimes I wonder if his story is even over, because we're quick to condemn him, but I'm not sure. If you turn to 2 Samuel, you read the lament that David sang over Saul and his son Jonathan, because, as you know, Jonathan and David were very, very close friends, some of the best friends the world has ever seen. And when David found out that Saul was killed, oh, please, Paige, turn. I command you to turn, Paige. Did it. Wow, that never works. David wrote a lamentation in verse 17. And he ordered that this song be taught to the people. It was that important. He said, your glory, O Israel, lies slain upon the high places. How the mighty have fallen. And this was Saul, who died in glory. He died in a very undignified way. Tell it not in Gath. Proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon. Or else the daughters of the Philistines will rejoice, and the daughters of the uncircumcised will exult. You mountains of Gilboa, let there be no rain or dew upon you, nor bounteous fields. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul, anointed with oil no more. But it was anointed at one point. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back, nor the sword of Saul return empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely, in life and in death, they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you with crimson and luxury. And that wasn't his goal, but he gave them a stability to their economy by taking care of the great dangers, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How the mighty have fallen in the midst of battle. And that's how David remembered his mortal enemy, with a beautiful, beautiful song. I like to think it's not over. You know, it is possible to commit sins that are to such an extent that people won't be in the kingdom in the world tomorrow. But I'm not sure Saul's there, because Saul was never, like the way we say, converted. Saul was used by God in a very special way, where he was never intended to be, you know, the kingly line of Judah. He was there for other reasons. And so the tragedies of his life are indeed tragedies. And I think they call for compassion on our part. I wonder if we won't see him in the world tomorrow as a physical person with another chance. And can you imagine him and David sitting together? And David explaining things to Saul and how things could be, and Saul seeing the glories that have taken place when things are done the right way. Well, I hope this has given you more insights into one of the most interesting people in the Bible, King Saul.